This is Molly Ball. I'm the national political correspondent for Time Magazine and your guest host this week on Left, Right, and Center. This is the show where we take on all the political issues, even the complicated ones that might divide your own family. It's the first week after Labor Day. This week, campaigning for the November 2022 midterms kicked into high gear. Primaries are mostly over. Candidates for House and Senate and governor and all the way down the ballot are starting to debate each other. President Biden's out there railing against what he's calling MAGA Republicans, making the case that democracy itself is on the line. Historically, midterm elections are bloodbaths for the party in power, and for months it's been the conventional wisdom that a big Republican wave was practically guaranteed. But recently, we've seen momentum seem to shift in the Democrats' favor. Some prognosticators are now saying the president's party could hold on to the Senate, even possibly the House. Let's bring in our left, right, and center panel to discuss these last 2 months before the midterms. I'm your host, representing the center. On the left, we're joined by Democratic strategist Zach Petkanis. And on the right, we're joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Molly.
Hey, great to be with you.
So, Zach, let's start with you. These latest poll numbers are making Democrats more optimistic than they've been for quite some time. We've seen Democrats overperform in a couple of recent special elections, one in upstate New York, one in Alaska. The generic congressional ballot is turned in Democrats' favor. Do you buy it?
Well, I think the key thing that you mentioned there is that we feel more optimistic than we did. And that was a pretty low bar compared to how Democrats were feeling a couple months ago. And it's true, we do feel better for the reasons that you are mentioning. That said, I tend to believe that the fundamentals matter a lot and historical trends matter a lot. As you correctly said, the party in power tends to face some headwinds going in to the midterms. And I think that's going to be exacerbated by a couple things. People's perception of the economy is not the best. People are facing some higher costs. But on the other hand, there are competing winds that are pushing us forward. One is a record of accomplishment from the Biden administration, passing really important pieces of legislation from the American Rescue Plan to the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill to recently the Inflation Reduction Act, which is going to do things that are really popular with voters, like lower prescription drug costs, the student loan debt forgiveness for 43 million Americans, really popular with 43 million Americans. And we have some good things to run against. In terms of the Republicans, there's the plan that was put up by Rick Scott, who's head of the NRSC, that talks about raising taxes on 500,000 Americans and putting Social Security and Medicare on the chopping block. So those are those things. In addition to that, which I think is really unique to this year, is the Roe v. Wade decision, which I know we're going to talk about a little later. So I think that those are the things that are competing against each other. And while I think that it is not going to be as horrific as we thought it was a few months ago, I am not convinced that we're going to sweep the way that some people are. I think that we have a really great shot at keeping the Senate. I think we have a shot at keeping the House. But these are going to be very close and down to the wire. And anybody who is taking things for granted on our side because they're reading, you know, some results from special elections or thinking about just the Roe v. Wade decision, they need to rethink that position.
Yeah, I mean, some of it seems to be atmospheric, right? You have gas prices coming down, COVID receding further and further into the background, people just sort of generally feeling better about life. But Tim, some of the Democrats' mojo really seems to be coming from Republican disarray, right? We've seen the rush to defend Trump against the FBI, Trump-endorsed candidates like Dr. Oz and Herschel Walker, who seem to be having a tough time selling themselves to voters, problems with fundraising, messaging, epitomized by, as Zach mentioned, the back and forth between Rick Scott, the chair of the Republican Senate Committee, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate. Are Republicans trying to lose the midterms, and is it working?
Yeah, I mean, with some of the candidates themselves, you think they're not necessarily trying to win. Dr. Oz running on bringing down the price of crudité in Pennsylvania didn't seem the best tactic. It's all the Donald Trump hangover. And conservatives like me who warned against nominating Trump and then said even in 2016, I'm not sure electing him is that good. What we warned is that there would be long-term consequences. And maybe they'll disappear after the midterms if Trump disappears. But as of now, all those factors you pointed to, the difficulty fundraising, the low quality of the Senate candidates, the the House candidates racing to defend stuff about Donald Trump that nobody should have to defend. All of that is a hangover of Trump, and that's what gives Democrats a chance. It's Bidenflation versus the Trump hangover is are the two forces that are going on here. And frankly, I think it's been enough. I mean, in Pennsylvania, Republicans had Pat Toomey, who is a combination of a conservative guy and a guy who was a very good politician. He's retiring. And so that seat, and as well as a governor racer, sort of got opened up to a competition of Trumpism. And then the quality candidate stuff that we talked about in Georgia, all of this is giving Democrats a chance in a election that they have no business having a chance. And the Republicans should be picking up seats in Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, New Hampshire, and maybe Colorado, and they might end up picking none of those seats up.
Wow. So what's your rating? We heard sort of cautious optimism, but no measuring the drapes for the Democrats from Zach. What's your prediction?
66% chance that Democrats keep at least 50 seats.
Wow. Well, what's needed here is clearly a political expert. So I want to bring in our special guest, Tara Palmieri. She's senior political correspondent for PUC. Hi, Tara.
Hi, Molly. Thanks for having me.
Tara, you've been talking recently with President Biden's longtime pollster, John Anzalone. We should say, if we're talking general approval ratings, polling for Biden has not been a happy subject. He's been on a steady decline pretty much since taking office. But we're seeing an uptick now, seeing a positive shift in Biden's favor, particularly since the Roe v. Wade ruling. According to 538, the polling average was down to 38% back in July, and now it's inched up to 44. So, Tara, what did John Anzalone make of these numbers? Is it something the president did, or are people just generally feeling better about things?
I think it's a combination of both. Some major legislation was passed, the CHIPS bill, Medicare, they set the tax rate. There was a major climate bill. It was all included in this Inflation Reduction Act in addition to the CHIPS bill. So there was some major legislation was passed. It shifted the narrative from when Democrats are in power in the House, Senate, and White House, they are unable to do anything except squabble within the ranks to, oh, wait, they're actually doing things. And they now have something to talk about on the campaign trail instead of the bills that they proposed but weren't able to pass, but what they were actually able to. I think that the gas price is going down, that helps Biden. I mean, some people correlate his poll numbers going down to the drop in gas prices every week. I have no doubt that pocketbook issues always come front and center. And yes, maybe there is a certain optimism when you go to the tank and you feel like things are starting to go in the right direction. But in terms of the actual candidates on the ground and what John Anzalone was seeing in the field with his many candidates and the polling that he's done, there's a big shift in voter turnout and enthusiasm, and a lot of it is around the overturning of Roe versus Wade and the Dobbs decision. You're seeing a huge uptick in registration, especially among women. It's front and center. Special elections are seeing candidates who are polling ahead of Biden, and they're doing a lot better. Even when they lose, they're still doing a lot better than the president is doing. And there's just a certain feeling of that this midterm that should have been a referendum on Biden has become a referendum on the Dobbs ruling. And that's a good thing for Democrats. So in some ways, that shift might be helping Biden as well.
Yeah, well, but usually when a president is unpopular, you see candidates start to distance themselves, not want to be seen with him, that kind of thing. How does the White House view Biden's role in these midterms?
I mean, Anzalone works for Biden. He still does. He works for the DNC and the Build Back Better organization that like pulls his policy. So he's obviously a cheerleader for him, and he thinks Biden should get out there and be talking about all the bills they passed and what they're doing. But I think ultimately, Biden should go where he's useful. He went to Maryland to campaign for Wes Moore. He went to Pennsylvania 3 times, but he was never really with a candidate in a capacity as in, like, I'm endorsing this candidate or I'm standing on the stage rallying with him. I believe Josh Shapiro, who's running for governor, was there with him at one of the events, but it was more in a capacity as attorney general, which is the role that he's in now. I think everyone's sort of like, we'd rather just run on this wave, on this feeling, than on the person that is Joe Biden. And I'm getting that sense. Like, he's not going down to Ohio. He's not going to Nevada, or at least not to campaign with these candidates. So I think they're kind of keeping him at a distance, I would say. But, you know, if he can get out there and talk about the thing, about the bills that they passed, and create the feeling that that leadership under the Democrats is a positive thing, I don't see why not. I think it really depends on the district, was the feeling that I got from that.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, there's been this odd separation where normally you look at the president's approval rating and it correlates pretty tightly with how the party's going to do. But even before Biden started getting more popular, there was this separation where the candidates were vastly overperforming him. My theory has always been that there's sort of a qualitative difference in people's opposition to Biden versus people's opposition to Trump, right? People loathed Trump, and obviously some people loved him, but to a large swath of the electorate, he was just sort of toxic, whereas a lot of people don't like Biden, but it feels more like disappointment to me. Like there's a lot of particularly independents who sort of hope things would get better, and for a large part of Biden's first couple of years, it felt like that just wasn't happening. Is that kind of your view?
I think so. I think you're right. I mean, I think that the quality of the candidate matters as well, right? And I think that these Democrats are smart to run on really hyper-local state-level issues and to sort of, you know, to talk to the people about what matters in their states. And I think also to talk about the bigger issue right now of abortion rights. And I just think that there is this kind of political earthquake that has happened. And, you know, as you said earlier, for the most part, the party in power sees losses in the midterm. The party of the president sees losses in the midterms, right? Except for a few rare moments. One of them was after 9/11, when really the party unified around George W. Bush. But right now we're seeing another cataclysmic moment. We have women in some states who are not able to get abortions, even in case of rape and incest. So this has really shifted the dynamic. I mean, we saw red Kansas, people coming out in the middle of the summer to shoot down a referendum that would ban abortion in their state. And I think that's just going to have such a big impact in November. And I think as long as they can make this election about Roe, I think that will change the game. And that was what I got from John Anzalone, who even admitted that when the draft was first leaked in May, that he didn't think it would be that big of a factor. Even after the overturning of Dobbs, he didn't think it would play that big of a hand in the election. But like, we're just seeing numbers and turnout and registration that indicates that this is a motivating force, and it's a motivating force for women.
As you mentioned, we are going to talk more about abortion later on in the show. But another complicating factor seems to be, usually the midterm is a referendum on the sitting president, but he's not the only president on the stage these days, right? I mean, this week we saw more developments in the federal probe into presidential records that led to the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago last month. Trump on stage in Pennsylvania called it shocking and shameful and an abuse of power. A judge granted Trump's request for a special master to review the seized documents, a decision that's been widely criticized by legal experts. And just this week, Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon, surrendered to authorities in New York on charges of fraud and money laundering related to political fundraising. So, Tim, I hate to make you continue to be the Trump guy, but it is your lot as a Republican. How enthusiastic are Republicans about the former president continuing to pop up in the news like this?
I mean, so Donald Trump is now a candidate about the past, right? About pretending that he won the 2020 election. And it's one of the rules that I've definitely observed in 22 years of watching politics in D.C. is that voters don't really care about the past. It's not like, you know, it's not like the sort of thing where, you know, baseball fans might stand up and applaud Albert Pujols because he gave them so many great years in St. Louis. No, even if they liked his first term, if he's just running about the past and about himself, I think it's infuriating a lot of the Republicans. On the other hand, the awkward position Republicans are in is that he brought in so many people who were itching to become Republicans because they loathe the culture warriorness, they loathe the East Coast elitism of the Democratic Party, and Trump was the one who brought them in. That's how he carried 2016. He even helped, like, Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania. He helped guys like that win by bringing some new Republican voters into the fold. So Republicans are in this position where they feel like their party is now defined by this guy who is simultaneously dragging down the party. So I disagree with Tara, and again, we'll talk about it later, but I don't think Dobbs is the albatross for the Republicans. I think it's Donald Trump. Again, you should be running against Joe Biden and his failures in this administration, and the inflation that you can chalk up to his massive spending, and to, you know, people remember the Afghanistan failure, even if most people don't vote on foreign policy, and he hasn't united the country, et cetera, et cetera. They should be running on Biden's failures, but instead, Donald Trump is making sure that he's the center of attention, and that is definitely going to hurt the GOP.
I do agree with Tim on that point, that I think Republicans are very flat-footed when it comes to Trump, and they're stuck defending him instead of attacking Biden, which has thrown in like a whole other third referendum, if you think about it, into the election of, is this about Trump or not? So I agree with you on that, but I still think Roe is going to impact voter turnout, which really matters in a midterm.
Well, I will be back with Zat Pakanis, Tim Carney, and Tara Palmieri to talk about the role of abortion in the midterm campaign. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, your guest host this week. On the left, we're joined by Democratic strategist Zat Pakanis. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And our special guest is Tara Palmieri. She's senior political correspondent for PUC. Let's drill down a bit on this issue that seems to be changing the calculus for both parties. As you mentioned, Tara, when Roe v. Wade was overturned in June, there was a lot of skepticism about whether it would have any political effect, right? People seem so locked in their partisan lanes these days. Very little seems to really shake up the political landscape. We know abortion's an issue that sharply divides Americans, provokes strong feelings on both sides. I remember hearing from some Republicans, they even thought the decision might help them by revving up their base. But Tim, that doesn't seem to be what we're seeing, is it?
It's unclear at this point how it's going to shake out politically. I mean, we're still early. And I mean, the first thing I'm going to say is Dobbs was the right decision. I said it when it leaked. I said it when it came out. There's no way the U.S. Constitution protects abortion. It was grievously wrong, and the Supreme Court was right to overturn it. And if that does end up costing Republicans a majority, then that's fine. I'll be just as fine with it as liberals were in 2010 when passing Obamacare cost them the majority. Or Liz Cheney, she thinks she did the right thing, and it cost her the election, and that might happen. The Supreme Court did the right thing. The Republicans did the right thing in getting that majority on the Supreme Court, and it could end up costing them. And one thing that I'll say, though, is it's interesting to me that the Democrats aren't primarily debating abortion right now. They talk about Roe being overturned because when you ask people, do you support Roe, they said yes. And then they jump to talking about treatment for ectopic pregnancies, or they talk about a baby who's miscarried or a baby who is totally non-viable, and can the woman get a treatment? And some of these horrible cases that are happening because doctors and hospitals may not understand what the law is. The fact that the pro-choice side is running to things that aren't actually abortion shows to me that there is a knowledge that abortion itself and the Democrats' position on abortion, which is absolutism, that's not popular. So that's why I say in the next couple months, we could see abortion go back to being neutral if it's about the Democrats' position of abortion on demand versus some of these six-week bans in states like Texas.
Zach, what kind of shifts are you seeing out there in the electorate? Is this, in your view, an earthquake that has upended the whole election, or is it just one factor among many?
I mean, look, I think it is an earthquake that is very likely to be the most dominant and important issue in the midterms. The level of anger and outrage amongst the Democratic base is palpable. You can feel it. It has changed the game on the turnout side on the Democratic front. From independents, it is another issue in which they are starting to feel uncomfortable with this Republican Party that is embracing extremism. And so, you know, I think that the Democratic candidates have been handling this in exactly the right way. They have been highlighting the fact that the Republicans are the party that have caught the car on this issue. They have no answer on how to address some of the many complicating factors that women face when they need to make a decision on whether to have an abortion. And you see these candidates who are just tying themselves into loops. You have Tudor Dixon, the candidate, the gubernatorial candidate in Michigan, who says that when a woman is faces, you know, when a victim of rape, that having the baby is a healing process for them. You have Dr. Oz, who is on camera saying that abortion is murder from conception and saying that incest really isn't that bad. You have Blake Masters in Arizona, who is forced to scrub his website and walk back his extremist position on abortion. You have candidates like Ron Johnson, who may have a more nuanced position on abortion, but because he praised the Dobbs decision that allowed Wisconsin to move forward with its draconian, virtually no exceptions law, he has to own that law too, which doesn't provide exceptions for rape or incest or the life of women. And so I think that the fact that Republicans were completely unprepared to talk about this in a way that is not alienating is having a really dramatic effect. And I just want to respond to one thing that was said, you know, about how abortion is a polarizing issue. I actually think that what we've seen over the last few months is that it's not as polarizing as people think. There is enormous unity in support of Roe v. Wade and the protections. It unifies Democrats, independents, and many Republicans. And Republicans who take this absolutist position on this that leads to punishment of women and doctors do so at their own peril. And I think that it's going to play a big, big factor in the midterms.
Respectfully, Zach misrepresented a variety of things here. The first thing is that Wisconsin's abortion law explicitly has an exception for protecting the life of the mother. Third thing is that basically every state that has a pro-life law explicitly says there is no punishment of women. And the final thing is, the extremism is, yes, there are Republicans. There are some clown in Idaho who is, you know, running on trying to outlaw, you know, even treatment of an ectopic pregnancy. So there are extremes. But the Republican Party, the extremists are mostly on the fringe. And in the Democratic Party, they're you know, star nominees. Tim Ryan, who used to be pro-life, who's running for that Senate seat in Ohio, he admitted he favors no restrictions on abortion. This is a case of a party that's held hostage by its radical extreme. Almost all Americans favor some restrictions on abortion. The Democratic Party position is that up until 9 months, for any reason whatsoever, a woman should be able to get an abortion. That is not a majority position. If that gets drawn out, that will change the politics of it. And I hope it gets drawn out not to help Republicans win, but to take Democrats away from that foul extremist position of abortion on demand.
I got to push back on the pushback here, because the Michigan law that the court just struck down from 1931, it did provide no exceptions for rape or for incest, and it called for jail sentences for women for up to 4 years, including doctors. The entire state Republican legislature there went to court in support of that legislation that is punishing women. We have laws in the state of Texas that is has gone to court to battle the Biden administration to allow them to deny emergency reproductive services to women whose life is in danger. And so the idea that that women aren't struck in the middle of this political battle by Republicans, that women aren't going to be punished in this, is simply not in line with the facts.
Tara, I'm going to bring you in to settle this.
I would just say, from having spoken to some Republican strategists, low-key, I mean, they're all kind of saying the same thing, that, you know, it's never great when you take something away from people, right? Like a right that you used to have, taking it away. And these are some people who are the biggest proponents of overturning Roe v. Wade. It's hard to play that. They don't exactly have a uniform position on abortion. And I would say that after the leak of the Dobbs decision came out in May, it was in the middle of the GOP primaries. And a lot of these, you know, these candidates candidates had to play as far to the right as they could to win a GOP primary. And I think right now they're kind of forced to sort of deal with that. And I think a lot of women didn't know about trigger laws and all of the news that's coming out, even just the stories that you're hearing about people having to cross over states. I don't know. I just think it's just hard to play when you're taking a right away from some people that they had before.
And at the state level, we're seeing, you know, as Zach mentioned, there are fights in the courts, and there's also state legislatures pushing forward with new restrictions on abortion. Tara, do you feel like this is going to be more relevant in those state races, or is it just as relevant at the federal level? Is it sort of an across-the-board phenomenon?
I think it becomes relevant when you know, Democrats are able to highlight that their opponent has an extreme position on abortion. I think that's the point is, and Republicans are trying to do the same thing by highlighting what Tim said about, you know, Democrats having extreme abortions, being able to have an abortion up until the end of, you know, until the final trimester and have it be government funded, as they say, you know, and it goes both ways. I think both in a general election, what they're trying to do is to convince those undecideds, right, those independents, and what is going to make them most cautious about voting for one party or another is an extremist stance on that issue. And I think that's what you're going to see a lot more of, are candidates playing up that the other side has an extreme position on it. And I do think that the voter registration, I'm looking at a story saying in Pennsylvania, the registration of women is going through the roof, motivated by the Roe decision. So I just think that in the midterm year, a lot of people don't vote. And if this is something that is going to drive up voters and bring them out to the polls in the midterms, I don't see how it doesn't have a huge impact.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about midterms, right, is that normally there are so many people who don't vote that anything that sort of reminds people that there's an election and that something that they care about is potentially on the line can be a game changer just because of that effect. And we were talking in the last segment about sort of the laws of nature where elections are concerned, right? This idea that midterms are always sort of a backlash against the president's party. And I've always felt like the best potential argument that might not be the case is 2018, that in the last midterm, we saw turnout really skyrocket to levels that are not normal for a midterm election, almost to presidential levels. You saw that in the Kansas vote on the abortion amendment as well, people turning out. And it's kind of a reminder that these aren't actually laws of nature, that people can vote if they want to. They just, most of the time in the midterm, they don't feel like they need to. And so I do wonder if, you know, in the era of Trump and post-Trump, if the game has just changed and voters are just more alert than they used to be, wired differently than they used to be, paying attention in ways that they didn't used to be. I mean, Tim, do you think it's possible that just the old rules no longer apply?
Absolutely. I mean, Trump kind of broke a lot of our rules, right? I mean, Philip Bump at the Washington Post had an interesting piece showing that it's Republican men of all groups, men, women, independents, Republicans, Democrats, Republican men have the biggest uptick in voter enthusiasm. I read that and I didn't have a good explanation for that. Maybe the polls are just wrong. Who knows? And then what I've always said, I used to work for Bob Novak, and I used to like go state by state, district by district, and look at this. And in some years, it really just was. 2002 really just was. You had to play it district by district. You couldn't look at national trends. So it could be that that's that. Nevada could cut, you know, it could be a Republican flip, while Pennsylvania and others are Democratic flips. And so those general laws of nature kind of stopped applying when the reality TV star came in and made us all look pretty bad.
Are there any other demographics you have your eye on? Because we've talked a lot about women voters, obviously, and the mobilization there. Tim mentioned sort of a mythbuster there that Republican men actually are the ones in polling saying that they're most enthusiastic about this election. And there's been a lot of talk about whether Hispanic voters are moving in the Republicans' direction and potentially other voters of color. What do you have your eye on, Zach?
I think a lot of the demographics you mentioned, you know, we need to be watching. But the ones that I'm really watching this midterm are young voters, 18 to 35s, and to see how they respond to what's going on. Because, you know, they're considerably more liberal on social issues than the rest of the population. And a lot of the things that they thought was settled, like Roe v. Wade, like marriage equality, which we're going to talk about a little later. are being pulled into called into question here. And I think it is, if not radicalizing, motivating them in ways that I think that we're going to start seeing. And I think in this election will be the first real wave of that. There is a real feeling that our way of life is under assault by the right wing, whether it comes to abortion or marriage, potentially a little bit of our economy, but also the violence that we're seeing. People think that this is not okay. And I think that we're going to see that translate specifically within within younger voters.
Well, but Tara, young people don't vote, right? I mean, what do you think about this idea that we're going to see a wave of young voters in the midterms?
Yeah, young people don't vote. That's right. I think it's interesting that, you know, Joe Biden had this last minute executive order to forgive student loans. Maybe that will help with some voter turnout among young people. But you're right, they generally don't. But who knows? This could be a motivating factor. You've got kids going to college with abortion pills in their hands right now. These feel like real issues that matter to them. Maybe they don't care as much about inflation or gas prices. But, you know, having some of their student loans forgiven, having real day-to-day issues to deal with when going to college, I don't know. Maybe they will go out and vote this year. This might be that moment. I mean, we saw them come out and vote for Obama. He had that sort of, he created urgency and enthusiasm for young people, and perhaps these two issues might as well.
Not in the midterms, though, right? Obama had a couple of really brutal midterms. Do you have any sense of how that student loan forgiveness is playing? I feel like I've heard a lot of claims from both sides about who it helps.
Yeah, you know, I don't really know. It's still kind of early to tell, but I do notice that a lot of Senate Democrats aren't using it on the trail, right? Cortez Masto is not talking about student loans. You're not hearing about it in Ohio. I think from Tim Ryan, I think people are using it if they think it can help in certain places like college campuses, et cetera. But I don't really see how it's playing. And then I've seen polling, you know, that shows that it's super popular. I still think the jury's out on that one. And then you're also seeing a lot of backlash, people saying this is unfair. It's going to add to the debt. Is it sustainable? So I'm not sure that it will have an impact. I think this is something we'll have to look at probably post-midterms to see if it had a real impact.
All right. Thank you. Tara Palmieri of PUC has been our special guest. Tara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Tim Carney and Zach Patkanis. We'll be back to talk about marriage equality legislation. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host, Molly Ball, coming at you from the center. On the right, we've got Tim Carney, columnist of the Washington Examiner. On the left, we're joined by Democratic strategist Zach Patkanis. Back in Washington this week, the Senate returned from summer recess, and one of the top items on the fall agenda is a bill to protect same-sex marriage. A bipartisan group of senators led by Democrat Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, the first openly gay senator, and Republican Susan Collins from Maine are trying to get support for a bill that would repeal the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, which allowed states and the federal government to refuse to recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, says he expects a vote this month on the so-called Respect for Marriage Act. Of course, gay marriage has been legal nationally since the Supreme Court's Obergefell decision back in 2015. So, Zach, why do this now? Is this purely symbolic or just a political ploy?
No, I mean, I think the Roe v. Wade decision, the decision to overturn what the Supreme Court justices during their hearings said was settled precedent, basically untouchable. They've made it clear that these points of what we think is just part of American life now, marriage equality, contraception, abortion, are very much up in the air. Justice Thomas put a very fine point on this when he mentioned those other issues as well, same-sex marriage, contraception, a few other pieces. And so there is a very real need to protect marriages like mine. They're clearly people that are trying to come and break up my family. and break up families like mine. And that is, so there's a real need to protect LGBT families. But on the other end, I think it really will highlight, and the fact that it's a fight to get Republicans on board, that there is a real contrast here when it comes to these issues. And really, it just goes into this sort of goulash of extremism that we are seeing in a post-Roe v. Wade world. The fact that they are having to negotiate with Republicans to support marriage equality, I think, is really telling, and is going to resonate with voters, and especially I think those young voters that I was talking about before. So I think it's a really important opportunity to get folks on the record, so they can say, which side are they on? Are they on the side for progress? Are they on the side to take us back to the 1960s? Are they anti-family? Are they coming to tear apart our families? And I think that's the message that we're going to start seeing.
Well, Tim, this is an issue where we've seen huge movement in public opinion in recent decades, as Zach sort of alluded to, right? The Senators Baldwin and Collins wrote a joint op-ed this week citing a Gallup poll that showed support for same-sex marriage moving from 27% in 1996 to more than 70% this year. According to Gallup, even a majority of Republicans now say gay marriage should be legal. The Respect for Marriage Act needs at least 10 Republican votes to pass. Do you think it will get that?
It depends, and it really depends on, I mean, we might have what sort of Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid did away with for years and Chuck Schumer, which was actual floor debates on amendments. And what matters to a lot of Republicans, and Rob Portman, who supports this law, has said that you've got to make sure that there are conscience protections. I mean, the sort of let us live our lives as we want argument for gay marriage or for abortion doesn't hold up if you're also going to say, by the way, you have to bake the cake that I want you to bake, or we're going to shut down your business. So to have conscience protections where people are allowed to marry whom they want, live with whom they want, etc., with the state's blessing, might require sort of putting into federal law again the idea that not just religious institutions, but individuals have a conscience right to participate in a ceremony different. And it would be a great debate to highlight the difference between a civil rights law, which has to do with can you sit at the counter or order a cupcake, versus which is a public accommodation, versus sort of participation in private contractor stuff. Again, whether you're a wedding photographer or something is a different thing. You're being asked to participate in a ceremony. And 90% of you might think you should participate in that ceremony, but still leave the right to opt out. So that's sort of, if the Democrats are willing to go along with believing in the conscience protection of individuals who do not agree with the majority, then this will get the 10 Republicans it needs.
Well, in the big picture, do you agree with Zach's basic take that Republicans are in a bind on this issue, though?
There are ways that it is. And to tie it back in with something Tara said, this is a way in which, ironically, it's a conservatism of the American voter. People distrust change. And there's something good about that, right? If you change our definition of marriage, we don't know what it's going to wreak. If you end up having abortion as a right that was protected by seven justices, you know, back in 1972 for two generations, we don't know what will happen when you pull it away. And so in this case, the status quo bias, even if it's only about a decade, is in favor of the Democrats on this. And so trying to take away something, trying to make a change, does upset voters. It's the same reason, again, that Obamacare costs the Democrats, because you said, well, you're trying to take away the healthcare system we had, the healthcare plan I had. So for Democrats to sort of use the status quo bias to their advantage is prudent, because it taps into the sort of natural conservatism, a small C conservatism of a lot of Republicans. And this is just amazing fundraising issue for Democrats. Joe Biden has always known that sort of disproportionately the political consultants, the candidates, the donor networks involve have been fighting for gay marriage since, 2000. And so to bring this up now can juice a donor base for the Democrats as well.
Well, Zach, I mean, as you mentioned, the Democrats are saying that this bill is necessary because the overturning of Roe v. Wade eliminated the idea of a constitutional right to privacy that Obergefell was also premised on. Are there other issues that could be affected here that the court could be considering?
Well, I mean, I think you just need to go down the list of what Justice Thomas mentioned. And, you know, the next one was contraception, which, again, I think is when you tell voters that there is a group of people who want to remove the right or allow states to regulate or deny the use of contraception, there is a massive backlash here. And I think this goes to the larger point. And one of the things that I've been advocating for Democrats to start doing, and I think that we're on the cusp of doing this, you know, when we've talked about the culture wars over the last 20 years, we have talked about it as a winning issue for Republicans, for them to go on the offensive and for Democrats to go on the defensive. And I think that with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, with some of the opposition that we're going to see to marriage equality, to some of the attacks on contraception, you know, we're starting to see efforts to ban books by like authors by Toni Morrison and others, that there is an argument to be made that we should be going on the offense on these culture wars and put these Republican medievalists on the defensive. They are advocating for a worldview that it does not comport with modern American life. And I think that they have benefited from the fact that people have thought that that has been settled and that we won't have to fight on these issues again. But as these individuals and extremists become more and more sort of conventional everyday candidates as they attain office, and these issues come to the forefront, it really is, in a lot of ways, waking people up to this idea that their life and the way their livelihood is under attack. And so I think that we're going to start seeing Democrats start engaging in culture war issues in a way that we haven't in the past, and in a way that is going to win elections.
Tim, what's your view on that? I mean, we've been talking for so long about how people vote their pocketbooks, right? And how the economy was so determinative of how people see politics and politicians. Are we seeing a return of the culture wars?
We're absolutely. I mean, I don't know that the culture wars went away. From my perspective, the left has been pretty aggressive on this attack for a while. I mean, the ACLU is trying to force Catholic hospitals to perform abortion. I do not feel like the Democrats have been on the defense. I do not think anybody is going to make any steps towards outlawing contraception. I can say Griswold v. Connecticut was a bad decision because it made up a constitutional right to contraception without thinking that anybody should outlaw it or will try to outlaw it. It won't come up because no state or town or whatever is going to pass a ban on it. And I think that the Democrats' efforts to scare, you know, the medievalists are going to take away your livelihood is really just, it's a fundraising-based motivating method. The culture wars have always been with us, and the parties have increasingly been aligning along those lines. That's why you see the Democrats doing well among wealthy suburbanites and Republicans doing better among working class whites, Hispanics, and blacks than they had been in the past. And so they never went away. They're here. They are going to rise in the forefront of our attention. And I think that if you mostly get your image of America from the major news outlets, you are going to be surprised that not everybody has signed up for the full cultural revolution that maybe our media elites have.
Sure. But I mean, I don't hear Republican candidates in tough races out there, you know, talking about critical race theory or you know, inveighing against this idea of wokeness, which was supposed to be such a powerful asset for Republicans in the whole culture war conversation. Do you see that still being a driver?
I think that you're going to see school boards around the country get overturned by voters who are upset at ideologues who care more about pushing certain gender theories or New York Times essays rather than educating their kids. And but on the national level, a lot of those things are not as pertinent. You do have Ron DeSantis trying to make it more central. And come the presidential election, when DeSantis steps on the stage, I think you'll see him sort of leading a culture war fight. And then we'll get the answer of how many people rally behind him, especially when he gets the full onslaught of the national media.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, it is your soapbox. Go ahead.
In the late 1960s, more than 40% of American school kids walked or biked to school. With the new school year beginning, we're down below 10%, according to the best estimates. And there's lots of roots to this problem. It's a problem, first, because it makes life harder for parents, because we have to drive them there. It makes kids less healthy, and it weakens communities. So what are the roots of this? Well, a couple of them are about public policy, but one of them is just about culture. First, school districts are too big, and schools are too big, meaning they take up too big of a geographic area, and school is much further away, necessitating school buses and parents giving drives. Economies of scale we get from this just aren't worth it. We need schools to be more local schools. Second, neighborhoods need to be built for people, not cars. And kids are people. We need to make it safer for kids to walk, crossing fewer big streets and things closer together with more paths for bikes and feet. And finally, as parents, we are too fearful. Governments can help here by fighting crime, but a lot of this, a lot of the disappearance of walking, has to do with us being helicopters who have bad understanding of what the actual risks are and a lack of belief in our own children's need for independence and ability to handle themselves on something simple like walking to school.
Zach Pitkanis, what's on your mind?
So as some people know, I used to work for Hillary Clinton, so I want to talk about the emails one more time. One topic that's been dominating the news lately is Donald Trump removing hundreds of clearly marked classified materials from the White House and storing them at his summer resort. They're stored in a personal office that his own attorney admits is frequented by many of his resort's guests. Surprising to nobody, Republicans are now competing with each other to defend Donald Trump's major national security breach as no big deal. Now, I can shrug off a lot of their spin as normal Washington garbage, but one piece of the spin is just really grinding my gears. That's their spin is that because Hillary wasn't prosecuted over a use of a private email server, it would be unfair to hold Donald Trump accountable for what he refused to return from Mar-a-Lago. They're even calling it the Clinton standard. But those that are making this argument are intentionally ignoring one key difference, what the Department of Justice IG said, that, quote, there was no evidence that the senders or former Secretary Clinton believed or were aware at the time that the emails contained classified information, unquote. On the other hand, Trump had hundreds of documents that were clearly marked as classified. We saw the photos. There was no mistaking it. So connecting the Hillary email obsession with Trump's situation is wrong, except for one thing. The fact that virtually every Republican is on the record now stating unequivocally that intentionally mishandling classified materials is disqualifying for the presidency of the United States. So I look forward to bringing up those quotes when Trump announces for president. Thank you.
Wow, a Republican who hates cars and a Democrat who actually wants to talk about Hillary's emails. Will wonders never cease? For my rant, last weekend, Jeff Gehrman, an investigative reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, was found brutally stabbed to death. And on Wednesday, Clark County Public Administrator Robert Tellez, a Democrat, was charged with Gehrman's murder. I used to be a reporter for the Review-Journal as well. Gehrman was one of the best reporters I've ever had the privilege to know. He was dogged and fearless. He broke news constantly, was a generous colleague, a tough competitor. Gehrman had broken a series of stories about Tellez's bullying and abuse of employees. Voters ousted Tellez in the recent Democratic primary. This is how accountability is supposed to work in a democracy. Public official does something wrong. Journalist finds out, exposes the truth. The public gets a chance to respond via the electoral process. Tellez had gone after Gehrman on Twitter, but never expected that to lead to actual violence. I want to express my condolences to Jeff's family and friends and the whole Review Journal newsroom, and I also want to express my outrage. Hopefully I don't have to convince you that murder is bad or that journalism is good. It's hard not to connect this to the heightened, toxic political climate in our country these days. No journalist should ever have to pause and wonder if it's worth it to get killed over a tough story before we publish. And it's not just reporters. Politicians, judges, FBI agents, public officials of all types increasingly face threats or actual violence just for doing their jobs. And this is unacceptable. If might makes right, we do not have rule of law in this country. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Tim Carney, Zat Pitkanis, and Tara Palmieri. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine-Million. Our production assistant is Alexandra Applegate. The show is recorded and mixed by John Meek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. I'm Molly Ball. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.